Hello, everybody. This is a great turnout. Thank you all for coming. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Professor Müge Göcek. I'll do that properly in a second, but first, I would like to thank the co-sponsors of this event, along with OTSI, the Ottoman Turkish Studies Initiative. We have the Near Eastern Studies Department, the Aynaudi Center for International Studies, and of course, the mother organization of the Ottoman Turkish Studies Initiative, Cornell Institute for European Studies. Professor Fatma Müge Göcek is she's a professor of sociology and women's studies at University of Michigan. Her research focuses on the comparative analysis of history, politics, and gender in the first and third worlds. She critically analyzes the impact of processes such as development, nationalism, religious movements, and collective violence on minorities. Her published works are numerous. I'm gonna focus on a few books. There's literally over 50. Her published works include East Encounters West, France and the Ottoman Empire in the 18th century, Reconstructing Gender in the Middle East, Tradition, Identity, and Power, which was co-edited with Shiba Balawi, Rise of the Bourgeoisie, Demise of the Empire, Ottoman Westernization and Social Change, Political Cartoons in the Middle East, Social Construction of Nationalism in the Middle East, and finally, well, not finally, this is the last one before the latest book, A Question of Genocide, Armenians and Turks at the End of the Ottoman Empire, which was co-edited with Ronnie Suni and Norman Neymar, thank you. And of course, the latest book, which is creating a lot of waves, this baby, The Denial of Violence. Me and my class have been engaged in it for the last week. The Denial of Violence is going to be the title of the talk as well, and it's, and the talk will be based on this book, which came out
November 2014.
Please help me welcome Professor Göcek.
Thank you very much. Let me get my water. I may need it. For having me here, Mustafa, and for enabling me to meet the people here and to share my work with them. It is a pleasure. The last time I was here was a decade ago at least, you know, when Mustafa's predecessor was here. Leslie Pierce, and she had invited me. So this has been a very long book to write. I thought it was going to be an easy one. And as a sociologist, we usually write our books very quickly. But this thing took me 12 years to write. And therefore, I thought, you know, I never realized when I got into it how contentious and how politically difficult and challenging it was going to write, but I'm delighted that I managed to finish and make some sense at least of what is going on. What I want to share with you, because the personal is political, and also I think it is important for us not only to share with our audience our work, but also to share with them the process through which we came to write the work we did. And I'm doing this because of the talks I've given on this topic. It's interesting that radical fractions from among both the Armenian and the Turkish community claim that I'm Armenian, which is fascinating to me, sociologically that is. Turkish nationalists think that I must be Armenian because my blood is tainted one way or the other, because no Turk in their right mind would say the things I'm saying. Armenians likewise think that I must be partially Armenian because they say that no Turk in their right mind would say the things I'm saying. So it's interesting that both you know, share the same. And as a consequence, I usually start my talk explaining how I came about writing on this issue, because as you know, I didn't used to work on this. I suddenly then started working on it, and I lost half of my friends and made new friends, and you know, and I also have lots of enemies and death threats, you know. I have a very exciting life now. So I thought it would be interesting to sort of talk about how I came to write what I did. And it's fascinating because initially, once I got tenure in at Michigan, it was time for me to come up with a, there are some seats over here, new book project. Initially, I was going to write on the Islamist movement in Turkey because I thought sociologically that was an important issue. And I started looking into it. I went and interviewed many people, including Abdullah Gül, but this was in the 90s, where a lot of what happened was that a lot of the people who actually you know, were parts of the Islamists constantly had to put up with military coups. I mean, you know, so whenever I presented my work on the Islamists, they said, well, if you want to study the Islamists, you should study the Turkish military instead, because it's evident that they're the ones controlling everything, not the Islamists, right? So nobody in Turkey has studied the Turkish military and is still around to tell about it. So I figured that was not a good idea, and therefore I decided not to do that. But I was very intrigued about the fact, why was it, I said, that Turkish society is so willing to accept military coups? Why is it that they have normalized and naturalized violence, you know, and why is it that they cannot tolerate difference? These were the kinds of questions that I was asking myself. And I, in order to sort of come to understand it, I said for violence to be such a big part of Turkish state and society, there must be a foundational violence that was not accounted for, that became normalized into society. And that is why I started looking back in history, since obviously dealing with contemporary politics in Turkey is not a very safe issue. I decided it was easier to go into history, it would be safer. Little did I know. So when you look back, the most significant, of course, foundational violence is the one that took is the Armenian genocide that takes place from 1915 to 17. And that is the one violence that has not been accounted for still by the Turkish Republic. Instead, there is denial, and people argue that denial is the last step of genocide. And as a consequence, I said I have to study this violence because it is the major obstacle in front of Turkey in terms of its democratization or lack thereof. That is how I chanced upon it. I usually start with that. The problem was, though, when I, and that's why I start with the Turkish past, I go, Turkish present, I go to the Ottoman past, and then, of course, I look at the collective violence against the Armenians. Then the issue became, well, I did look at it, but when did this violence stop? Start and when did it end? I mean, you know, what was going to be the time frame within which I was going to study this violence? When I looked at it, of course, before the 1915-17 genocide, there is the 1894-96 massacres that predated. As a consequence, it was evident that this was happening before, and there are the 1909 Adana massacres. So I started going back. How far back can you go? I decided to stop at 1789, not because it is the start of the French Revolution, although that would have been nice too. Instead, it is the coming to the throne of Sultan Selim III. And what is important about Selim III's reign and thereafter is that this is when the Ottoman Empire starts to systematically modernize. And with modernization and modernity, I think things started to polarize, and communal rights that used to be the rights that protected a community, including the Armenian community as well as the two other non-Muslim communities of Jews and Greek Rum, they lost their communal rights and instead they had individual rights. And once they were given individual rights, they had to have state protection for those rights to sustain. And that state protection was immediately lifted, leaving them basically open to violence. And as a consequence of that, violence started. So that was my beginning point, 1789 and modernity and the polarization and violence it led to. With respect to the end point, I have been born and raised in Turkey, in Istanbul. And I knew from my own experiences that there was a lot of violence, symbolic violence, of course, not physical as much, but still a lot of prejudice and discrimination against the Armenians that have just continued basically to this day. As a consequence, I tried to bring it as close to the present as I possibly could. And that is why I decided to stop at 2009, because it was a nice round number that gave me 220 years. And I had to stop sometime because I had to write the book. And that's why I stopped at 2009. And that is why that's the end point. And I argue then the collective violence is not solely the 1915 phase. There is a beginning and there is a continuation to this day. And how do I know that it is a genocide? Basically, what happens is that if you look at the population of the Ottoman Empire in around 1897, there are about 20% of the population is Armenian. Today, when you look at how many Armenians there are in Turkey, it's 0.02%. So obviously, we're talking about a very significant reduction. Had there not been genocide and gradual attrition that has continued from the imperial times into the republic, there ought to be about 20 million Armenians in Turkey today, and there are not. So that in itself demonstrates that there was a violent destruction. And this is the destruction that I wanted to focus on. And that's why I chose the dates I did. And I should say, also share with the fact that I never doubted that what happened was a genocide. That debate is past. That was a debate we used to have 10, 15 years ago. And to me, what was unfortunate was the fact that after the foundation of the Turkish Republic, with Turkish nationalism and the centralization of education in Turkey, history textbooks whitewashed the past so that we growing up in Turkey had no idea what had happened to the Armenians or the Jews or the Rum, or you know, who were all basically destroyed at various junctures by the Turks. According to the textbooks, we were always innocent. We always had good intentions, and others were violent, but we weren't. And that, of course, is a telling of history that not only was there from the beginning, but continued to this day. It was only after coming here for my dissertation work at Princeton that I started realizing that there was another history there. There was another past, and that had a lot of violence against the Armenians. And as I started talking then and acknowledging what had gone on, I realized the damage that denial does to both Armenians and to the Turks as well, to both the victims and the perpetrators. When one talks, as I did, to diaspora Armenians especially, they would talk about 1915 as if it happened yesterday. I mean, the emotions and the idea is so close to them. And why? Because if you deny something, if you do not acknowledge it, the open wounds never heal. And because they don't heal emotionally, they are always with you. And unfortunately, over generations, it is that emotional wound that keeps being passed from one generation to the other. And that is also what, in a way, not only draws away all the energy that people have, but it also undermines people's trust in humanity. You can no longer trust that humans are inherently good people, because your own experience has demonstrated that somebody has done something evil and has gotten away with it. That, as a consequence, leads you to lose your hope. in the future and in others. So that is the damage it has done Armenians. And I also know that there is a very strong, of course, psychological and emotional component. So I always start my talk this way. I personally, as an ethnic Turk, a Turkish citizen, and a scholar, personally apologize for all the things that happened to you and your ancestors, and all the pain and suffering you had to bear as a consequence. I am not guilty, but I am responsible. I am responsible to make sure that such injustice is one day righted. It is important to me ethically and morally to do that, and it is also important for me as a scholar to make sure that that happens. And that is why I am working on this myself. I am also working on it because the lack of acknowledgement damages Turkish society as well, the perpetrators. And in a way, they also, in their way, because they got away with the violence that they undertook, that they were never held accountable for what they did, they continued that destruction and that violent streak into the Turkish Republic and basically exercised and used it against other people, like the Kurds, Alevis, women, and in general, because the violence became also normalized in Turkish society, and the Turks themselves also do not believe in humanity and the goodness, and they don't trust it either, because in their case, what's fascinating is that what happens is that they think they can get away with anything, and they can get away with violence. So that is why they also do not trust, and they lose as a consequence their moral compass. And that is why Turkey also, the Turks need to come to terms with the past as well. So these are sort of the reasons why this is a very important issue for me and why I started working on it. What I will do now is I will take you through and explain within this context how I started. So if you look at the contested memories of 1915, what is sort of the issue here? The most significant one, of course, has to do with two different standpoints. On the one side, we have the contemporary Western scholarly community and the diaspora that argues this is one of the first genocides of the 20th century that occurred during 1915. I say 22 because some say 15 to 17 or 15 to 19 or 15 to 22 basically is the end of the War of Independence. 23 is basically when the Turkish Republic is founded. With the intent to annihilate, this is very important. There is an intent. The intent was annihilation, and there is also a lot of debate around that. And between 800,000 to 1.5 Armenians, and that is basically 800,000 is the figure given at the time by the government, the Ottoman government, and 1.5 million is another estimate, mostly by the survivors. The standpoint of contemporary Turkish state and society was instead that it is not a genocide, but reciprocal Turkish and Armenian massacres. So there is this sort of assessing, blame to both sides, the violence and, redistributing violence with unintentional destruction, of course, largely due to travel conditions of Armenians deported from the war front due to military security. This is usually what is said, leading to, interestingly enough, 100 to 400,000 Armenian deaths and at least 1.5 million Turkish wartime deaths, which is in and of itself a miraculous figure, because basically all the Armenians of the empire have to take on the Turks, including the women, children, and the elderly, for them to be able to kill that many Turks. What is happening here is that basically, I'll explain later, they are equating the civilian deaths that the Armenians suffered with the wartime military deaths of soldiers that the Ottoman army suffered. So they are comparing not apples and oranges, but apples and Brussels sprouts or something, you know, that is totally uncomparable. And but the important thing is, even though all the different aspects, elements of the standpoint of contemporary Turkish state and society are not based on facts, why is it that they can still sustain this discourse to this day? That is what I could not understand, because I was born and raised in the Republic. Of course, you could, and this happened before the Republic, so why didn't they say, hey, it happened in the past, we have nothing to do with it, we are the Republic, let's just move on, and, you know, sorry, and move on. Why cannot they apologize for something that happened in the past? Why is it still with us to this day? So that is what I am. I'll give the answer, don't worry. I'm sure you know it too, but why do Turkish states and society deny what happened to Armenians in 1950? What does this denial entail? When did it start and when will it stop? So those are, of course, the questions that I was asking. And what I tried to do is I tried to, because it takes such a long time period, I said, what can I use to study this period? I could have used official state and government documents, and I do know Ottoman. I have worked in the Ottoman archives for my earlier books, even though, of course, I see a lot of messages and whatever, hate mail says, you know nothing about Ottoman. I mean, I was going to say, hey, do your homework. I mean, you know, at least look to see what I've written and what sources I've used. But nevertheless, those documents themselves are socially constructed documents. They tell everything from the vantage point of the state, and they do not give any voice to the minorities, to those who are the victims. They, of course, privilege the standpoint of the perpetrators just in the way they are constructed. I could have also looked at, so I didn't look at them, because I wanted to be able to see what the people thought rather than the state. Because I'm not interested only in state denial, I'm also interested in the denial of society. As a sociologist, to me, the complicity of society is much more intriguing and challenging than the other ones. Turkish and minority literature is another way. There is a lot of Turkish literature that has not yet been studied with this project in mind. With respect to a lot of Armenian sources, ever since the end of the Cold War, from like the year 2000 onwards, they have started translating Armenian literature, but there, and I have written one or two articles on that, but there isn't enough to cover the all 220 years yet. Oral histories, accounts and interviews promulgating, I mean, or sort of, you know, in a way, distributing or claiming that the genocide happened in Turkey is legally actionable if you are a Turkish citizen living in Turkey with a prison sentence of 1.5 years. If you are a Turkish citizen who makes these claims outside, so-called claims, outside of the country, it's 3 years imprisonment. If you are like me, a Turkish citizen living in another country, it's 4.5 years of imprisonment. So in a way, it is very hard to get any oral histories going, especially when there is such a statement or legal framework that actually inhibits it. In spite of this, however, there are people like Ayşegül Altınay, Leyla Nezi, Orhan Pamuk didn't actually, but yeah, he also acknowledged it. Nevertheless, these are starting to take place, but recently they do not go back much either. So I decided instead to use contemporaneous, mostly Muslim Turkish memoirs, because these cover a very wide range, and they include all kinds of people. So what I looked is, I tried to look at all these memoirs that were written in Turkey, in Turkish, after the 1928 Latin script reform, so that these were technically all material that was available to Turkish society had they chosen to read it. But they chose not to, obviously. In order to do this, I decided in a moment of madness that I would look at all the memoirs that were ever published in Turkey in Turkish, which meant that I had to probably read about 700 to 800 memoirs. It's a good thing that I'm a speed reader, so I can read a lot. Of those, I took copious notes of those that had information on minorities and violence and the combination of the two. And that is how I ended up with 300 plus memoirs. And I had I was brought up bilingually, so I can translate into English very quickly. So I took notes. I had 1,000 pages of single space notes on the, you know, on what I found in these. I, of course, was also very careful to contextualize things across time and space, look at the impact of the past on the present, interacting of the internal and external forces. I didn't want to only say it's the West, you know, and let's look elsewhere to understand what's going on in Turkey, or I didn't say it's only Turkey, the rest didn't matter. It's a combination of things. And most importantly, interface of structural and cognitive processes. And I'll explain what I mean by that later. So what I did was analyze the course of Turkish, Ottoman Turkish history in relation to the contemporary denial of violence from 1890 to 2009. 297 memoirs I looked at, and 315 texts, because many people wrote more than one memoir. What's interesting about it is most of this, about 85% of them, are memoirs of Turkish Muslim officials or officers. And among them, I have 8 to 10 who are actually perpetrators themselves of the, you know, violence against the Armenians. And this is, of course, very interesting to be able to see what they had to say. And in the process, what was very interesting is because I'm able to have so many memoirs, a lot of people self-censor themselves or silence themselves. And by putting it all together, I could see exactly what it is that they are not saying. So that was the beauty of you know, using this as a puzzle to demonstrate what was and was not working. What was my model? I thought that, you know, as I said, modernity there led to the polarization of you know, society. But what was important here is the public emotions, because all societies are polarized, but rarely is there a jump to collective violence. And because of that, public emotions, collective emotions, become very important in literally getting people to actually physically engage in violence. And in this jump, of course, the public emotions, nationalism is extremely important. Nationalism pits people against one another. And then what's fascinating is that after the violence occurs, you would expect people to say, hey, this was violence, you know, let's, what shall we do about it? Rather than saying that and acknowledging publicly what happened, you instead have denial. So that is, of course, something that people haven't studied before. Why do they not acknowledge it? Why do they deny it instead? And there I look at certain, because I was looking at so many memoirs, I was able to see how they basically used and abused certain events to justify the violence against the Armenians. And that was why, you know, I was you know, very interested to see how and why they took many events out of context and used it as a way to continue their denial. And this is all 12 years, and this is what we get. This is it, basically. This is my model. So if you look at the violence against the Armenians, the red one, that is the most important. I start with the 1894-96 massacres. This, I say, is phase one, 1789 to 1907. I say then, second is 1915 to 17. I call it ethnic cleansing, because that's how it's referred to in the literature. That's phase two. It's the Young Turk period, 1908-18. People have looked at this. Only they usually very rarely do phase one. I then continue into 1919 to 74, and there, 6-7 September 1955, pogroms are very important. Only about a dozen or two dozen people die, but they destroy all the property and goods non-Muslim minorities have, mostly the Greek room, but they also destroy the property and goods of Jews and Greek room and Armenians as well. And then the final phase is 75 to 2009, and there the 19th of January 2007 assassination of Hrant Dink is a very significant violence, I think, against Armenians again, because to this day his the perpetrators, except for the one who pulled the trigger, have not been caught and brought to justice. So that I think there is still the continuation. And what is very interesting is that in each case there is a denial. The first denial is the denial of the domestic origins of the issue. The second one is the destructive intent of Armenian deportations. The third, and this is probably, well, the survival of perpetrators into the republic with impunity. And the final one is the responsibility of violence against the Armenians. If you look at the first one, the domestic origins, the denial occurs as such. Usually what happens is that with the reforms, especially with the 1839, 56, and 76 reforms, the Ottoman state promises equality to all its minorities, subjects who have become citizens. It fails to deliver it. It only allows the Armenians living in urban centers, mostly Istanbul and Izmir, to accumulate wealth through trade with Europe insofar as they remain apolitical. So that those, and this is why I think there is so much hatred towards the Bolis Armenians, because they were fine and they sort of didn't really care what happened to the other Armenians living especially in East Anatolia. What happens in East Anatolia instead is because the Kurds are being settled in the 1850s and the Kurds usurp literally the lands of Armenians that has been in Armenian use, especially belonging to monasteries and churches for for centuries, if not a millennia, because Armenians there are the oldest people in these lands and these are their ancestral lands. Because of that, there is a lot of violence against the Armenians and impoverishment of Armenians in East Anatolia. And so this in itself obviously demonstrates that the origins of the conflict is actually local, domestic. It starts in East Anatolia, and if you look at the riots that occur, they mostly occur in East Anatolia. Then they are brought to Kumkapı and to Istanbul when they do not get any acknowledgement. But what is very important in that context is the 1896 Ottoman Bank takeover. This is the Ottoman Bank is a European bank with European partners. The manager is French. A group of Armenian revolutionaries decide that they would take over this bank to draw attention of Europeans to what is happening. And what happens that, of course, is that when they have, when they take over, this is the first time at the European, at the imperial capital that something like this has happened. Everybody is in shock. And Abdulhamid, of course, says that he is going to let them go if the European powers are willing to take them. And what happens is that the French manager of the bank, accompanied by the Russian embassy people and others, takes the Armenian revolutionaries. They all come out of the bank, and then he takes them and puts them in his yacht that he owns, and the yacht takes them to France. Abdulhamid II uses this to say to his people, to the subjects, they say, see, this was all a Western plot to start with. They came, they sent these Armenians as puppets, and now they're taking them back. So that the first denial, therefore, is the denial of the domestic origins of the issue, even though this is, this is due to a failure, a domestic failure. It is And to this day, whenever this issue comes, still in Turkey, they talk about all the Western powers, they are the ones who are instigating this, and everything was fine, and Armenians were living in peace. They weren't. I mean, you know, they were suffering. So it's important in that context. The second one, and that's the sort of, I talk about the modernity and polarization, you know, within minorities, between the Volis people and the provinces and such. But I will only focus on the second phase is very important when the Young Turks come, because there what happens is that the Balkan Wars are very significant, because at the Balkan Wars, the Ottoman Turks think that they have been personally, the hypocrisy of Europe basically. This has destroyed them, and they have lost all the land in the Balkans because the Europeans before the Balkan Wars say that whoever wins, the borders are going to stay the same as if it were before the war. After the Balkan Wars, when they realize that the Balkan states are able to defeat the Ottomans, they say wherever the cross goes in, the crescent has to recede, so that they go back on their word and let the Balkan states keep the lands that they have conquered, and therefore this is seen as a huge blow to the Ottomans, who take to the streets saying vengeance, vengeance. Of course, they are not strong enough to take these Western powers on, so they turn to the only Christians within the empire that are their subjects and that are not protected. And that is how it's much easier for them to destroy the Armenian subjects and replace them technically with all the refugees from the Balkans. And they think that the Balkan refugees will take it from there and continue. And they do not, because Armenians have been able to accumulate skills, trade skills, a lot of other skills, and they cannot be replaced by mostly peasants who come from the Balkans. And as a consequence of these forced deportations, where they take the Armenians usually out of the cities, where they separate the women and children on the one side and elderly on the one side, males, adult males and males above 10 on the other, they usually massacre all the adult males and the children. On the other side, they either also, again, rape or massacre, or in other cases, let people in the surrounding places to actually come and adopt some of the children or the women and destroy others. Elderly don't have a chance to live, and mostly younger women do. And they therefore argue, for example, today in Turkey, they say there are about 2.5 million Islamicized Armenians, of people of Armenian origin, that are still there as a consequence of this forced violence that they have to get through. What is very important is that the intent definitely is to destroy. They want to claim Armenians' ancestral lands. The Turkish Ottoman Turkish state wants to claim it for themselves, and that is why they undertake this destruction. But the second denial is that even though this is the intent, they hide it, and publicly they always claim that it was just, you know, a collateral damage, and it was a part of just a wartime measure that went awry. I mean, so this is the second denial, and I would argue probably that the Balkan Wars and that vengefulness had something to do with the second denial. The third phase is once we start having, the Turkish Republic, and here educational modernity is especially important, because they whitewash the past and basically erase all traces of all the violence they committed. I mean, and they committed mostly violence against the Armenians, because unlike the Greek Rum, the Armenians did not have a place to go to. The Greek Rum, once they also, you know, were violent against eventually, were able to escape to Greece. the Jews never were, there were never enough of them, and they had no claim to the lands as their lands, so that wasn't a problem. So it was only the Armenians, basically, who had a claim and were destroyed as a consequence. But none of that is any longer an issue because of the military tribunals. I mean, there, presumably, of course, what happens, and this is the tragedy, this is sort of explains my initial question, why doesn't Turkish Republic recognize what happens? What happens is that Britain and other the Allied powers say, they issue a note in 1915 saying, if and when we win the war, all of you who have perpetrated this crime against the Armenians are going to be held accountable. So the moment they win the war, they come to Istanbul and they say, okay, they start sending people and arresting the perpetrators. But half of the perpetrators get arrested, end up in Istanbul in prison. The other half, knowing that they're going to be arrested, instead escape to Ankara and join forces with Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. What happens is that in the end, when the war, of course, independence war is won, former perpetrators become Republican heroes. So that is what the problem is. The problem is as that the perpetrators not only survive into the Turkish Republic, but they are not punished. Only a handful of them are punished. The rest occupy very important places in Turkish society, especially in Turkish state. Important among them, for example, is two Turkish prime ministers and presidents. One is İsmet İnönü, who was the head, unofficial head of the Teşkilat-ı Mahsusa, the special organization, and Celal Bayar, who also was a member of the special organization. It is that continuity into the republic that stops Turkey from recognizing the genocide, because they have to acknowledge that their republican heroes were actually former perpetrators, and they also have to come to terms with the fact that the major significant corporations and businesses in Turkey, also the Turkish Republic itself, was built not solely on the blood, sweat, and tears of the Turks, but on the blood, sweat, and tears, the properties, and the wealth of Armenians as well. And that is very difficult for them to acknowledge. And that is why it is such a foundational violence. And that is what needs to be looked at. And the military tribunals have some problems, but I'll get into that later. The last phase is important. The phase has to do with the Yanukyan and the 75-86 Justice Commandos of the Armenian Genocide and the Armenian Secret Army for the Liberation of Armenia assassinations of Turkish diplomats. And this is important. In this 10-year period, about 38 diplomats are assassinated. And what it does to Turkish state, at this point, they think the Armenian question is closed, that there is nothing, you know, there anymore, and there aren't too many Armenians left in Turkey either. Suddenly, when Yanukyan is being tried in L.A., they sent a message, the public prosecutor sends a note to the Turkish Foreign Ministry saying, what is your stand on this, you know, on this issue? And they say, they look into it and they don't have anything. They just have like a four-page pamphlet in English on the Armenian issue, and that's it. And then they suddenly realize they have to come up with an official discourse. And that is when, very interestingly, according to Kamran Gürün's memoirs, who is a diplomat, they call all of the scholars from all over Turkey. And he says, we called them to Ankara, we told them, this is how you should write our history and demonstrate how the Armenians who are violent today were also violent in the past. And they say, well, they say these scholars are a weird bunch, he says, because we told them what to do. Not only did they not do what we told them to do, they instead told us how we should go about this ourselves. So obviously, they go back to the scholars don't get into it. And to this day, until recently, no decent scholar in Turkey would write on this. And the people who do write on it are usually second or third rate scholars, because if you have any respect of academic principles, obviously you won't go into this type of reasoning. So what happens instead is they need to have something. Gurin and others recruit all retired diplomats. They send all the retired diplomats who also know Ottoman into the archives, and then of course they look at history only highlighting the violence of the Armenians, not at all going into the violence of the Turks against the Armenians. And that is how you get this bizarre thing about mutual massacres and everything, because the people who are doing the research are not academics. They are retired diplomats. So what happens is that because of that, the last instance of violence is the responsibility of violence against the Armenians is denied as a consequence of this thing. So this is basically a very quick summary of my argument. And there, of course, I argue that the fact that this is not accounted for also leads eventually to the very recent assassination of Dink, because the state is still complicitous in the continuation of the violence and discrimination against the minorities. I want to end with one memoir to give you a sense of what the memoir carries. This is a memoir of Nermedil Yener Binark, who's probably in her 70s now. And it gives you a sense, when you look at it thoroughly, how you come up with these very different accounts and how the puzzle, pieces of the puzzle fit. What's important here is her father is Ahmet Faik Ener, actually, who she thinks is a nameless hero, adventures, fairy tales, assassination, whatever. I mean, you know, directorship of the police, Malta deportee. And if you look at the third paragraph, this is on page 10, and on page 55, you realize what the father was accused of. Well, he was the police chief of Talat Pasha, so that should give you some idea. The arrest of four British persons, but he was held responsible for the deportation of 27,000 Armenians. It wasn't deportation. He massacred them. I mean, so obviously that is why it's interesting, of course. She sees him as a hero, but he is actually a perpetrator. This evidently worried him so much that he never engaged in politics to become a state official ever again, even when Atatürk twice called him to Ankara to report for duty to the fatherland. So you also see this nationalist discourse. That is one side. The mother, on the other hand, has a totally different experience. So if you look at the past second paragraph, she was 18. She was going to Antep in 1915 for the newly wedded husband. And the voyage, she says, we were passing through the Gyavur Infidan Mountains by horse carriage. People on the road were migrating. Again, it doesn't say they were forcefully being sent. Many elderly children, women walking in the ice cold air, some so much covered with flies, you could not make out their faces. Some took a couple of steps, fell and died. Many begged to get into the carriage. One woman attacked my carriage, crying, let me be your slave. Kulun olayım, take me. Beni de al. People died while walking. At night, children's cries of Mayrik, Mayrik rose from the tents. It was terrible. We had fallen right into the middle of the Armenian migration. So you get a sense. Then the two discourses come together. Years later, when the father is 84, so this is probably around when the Asala and JCOAG murders are taking place, my mother said something against it. Yet my father, who had been lying calmly in his bed, suddenly came alive and, 84 years old, pounding his fist against the comforter, said to my mother, if I were born again, I would have done it again. Do you get that, Ayşe? I would have done it again. Even in his last minutes, whenever a national issue came up, he became alive and cried up. And this gives you a sense of how nationalism is able to penetrate into all pores of society. One, now in the last 10 years, thankfully, Turkish society, at least civil society, has started to come to terms with, and I hope my book too will contribute to that dialogue, so that once again Anatolia, Asia Minor, Western Armenia will be a place where we are able to come together and live like once we should have a long time ago, before such violence unfortunately took that option away from us. Thank you.
Can I say that she was an excellent presenter of this issue? And I think you have heard many who have spoken on this campus.
Yeah.
And I commend you highly for
Thank
being
you.
A very fair presentation.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Well, it's my obligation as an academic. Yes.
Do you have books for sale?
I only have one book. It's on Amazon and other Oxford University presses, the one that published it. So the books are very heavy. It's 644 pages. Oh, they have it in the bookstore? Yeah.
You ordered them for the class.
Oh, you ordered them for the class. Yes.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
I wasn't here in the beginning, so I'm not sure when you started. Did you mention that when Sultan the Conqueror, Mehmet,
Yes.
Okay, so what did you do with the minorities? Did you mention that?
No, I didn't, because I start later with 1789.
Well, I'd like to mention that if I may.
Okay, well.
You let all the minorities practice their religion.
Yes, you did.
And
yes.
Respected them.
Yeah.
And I am all with you. I think I hate all the wars.
Yes.
So I'm not going to argue as you are arguing. Make generalizations. I think I found a little bit too strong your generalization of lumping all the Turkish people as violent.
I did not say violent.
No,
I did not
Turkish
say Turkish. Turkish state is definitely there.
I'd love to tell you something. I am older than you are, and my father was almost 50 when they had me. I'm the last child. I'm from Istanbul, Turkey.
Yeah.
And I've been living in this country much longer than I ever lived in Turkey. My father was in the army. He was born in Yugoslavia, former Yugoslavia, brought to Turkey as a seven-year-old and given to Turkish army so that his widowed mother can get money.
Yeah.
Among his brothers. And then he became a young Turkish soldier, officer actually. During that time, you were talking about nationalization. It wasn't limited to Turkey. The whole Europe, everybody was getting very, very, if you read Bernard Lewis.
Bernard Lewis was my mentor at Princeton, so I know his work very well.
My master's degree is on also Turkish history, even though it is anthropological study.
What are you then in academia?
I've been in on and off.
But you see, that is the difference between you and me, because I have been working on this for 12 years.
I have.
Yes, but the you personally have one experience. Definitely, I can give you. Yes, I know. I have my grandfather as well. But this is personal.
Okay.
The other thing is, I'm talking to you about 300 memoirs. I've read about 700.
Let me give you one memoir too, which is you would like to hear it. Everybody would like.
But is it printed in Turkey in Turkish?
I am going to give you my father's personal experience of during the independence Turkish war.
But that is not of interest to me. Thank you very much.
It
but
is
the
very
problem
is,
I do not want
you.
To. Well, I am stopping you because to me the important.
A very good story. Other people will appreciate too. My father was left with a typhoid fever. Turkish armies thought he was dead. They pulled out. When he opened his eyes, this is after the genocide, he found himself in this old woman's home. She was an Armenian woman.
Okay.
He found her.
Okay.
Took her, this Turkish soldier.
Yes.
Cured her. And
yes.
Brought him back to life.
Well, that's
so there are all these.
I totally agree. Well, that's not only the one case. There are also righteous Turks. There are many Turks who oppose the deportation.
I think that it should be acknowledged that there was, like the Hitler, what Hitler did.
Yeah.
What we are even doing today.
Yes, with
country,
the Turks, yes. Yeah.
Not with the Turks. Americans going to Afghanistan or Pakistan
Iraq.
Or Iraq.
Yes.
I'm through.
Okay,
no,
good.
Thank you for
you're welcome. You're welcome. But now you will leave. Yeah,
I
because
think I found your talk very intense. So.
Well, I'm glad you were here, and of course you should stay till the end if you are interested, because you basically made your statement and you're leaving now, which is unfortunately it is not the end yet. I think you should sit and listen to the rest.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Holly.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, this is really interesting. I have a question because you mentioned this issue of open wounds never healing. I'm wondering, I mean, there seem to be a lot of cases where there is mass violence, but
yes.
somehow it doesn't result in a lot of I'm thinking of the Stalinist purges, for
yes.
example.
Yes.
People don't talk about the Stalinist purges in Russia, and it's not pathologized in
the
same
way. Yes.
And I'm wondering if you could talk about
yes.
why it is some things
rather than
or, you know,
others.
Or
yes.
Is it really
yes.
that the, you know the, this that a trauma necessitates you know
yes.
A particular kind of response? Or that there are historical circumstances that might determine what kind of response emerges, and
yes,
or
yes.
community treatments, or
well, what I'm trying to argue is that because denial is so layered and it takes so much over time, it becomes especially difficult because it is multi-layered for Turkish state and society to accept it because it is so layered. The problem is that with violence, usually, it takes at least a couple of generations for a society to come to terms with the social impact of violence. But in this particular case, for one to be dealing with violence, and this is, for example, why soldiers with PTSD in the American society after the Iraqi and Afghani incursions, what happens is that usually those who commit suicides are the ones who cannot come to terms with the fact that they have actually suffered and they are ill. I mean, you know, and this is, so it's the ones who cannot acknowledge the violence that they were a part of that have a very hard time coping with it and moving on. And in this case, what is very important is that in order, if you have been hurt, in order for you to deal with that wound, you have to publicly need it to be acknowledged so that if you go to someone and say, I am hurt, I want to heal, people don't say to you, it's a figment of your imagination, you're not hurt. It just feels that way to you. I mean, there has to be acknowledgement for that healing process to start. That is the problem in general. So, I mean, people always say to me, well, what about the Native Americans and African Americans in this society? They also underwent a lot of violence, yes. But if you talk about that violence, people don't say to you, you're obviously making this up, and we didn't do any of that. I mean, that is the major difference. If both publicly, by the state and by society, your suffering is not recognized, that is when it metastasizes and it becomes very hard to heal because it is not openly acknowledged. That is the problem. That is the major difference. I mean, that is why, for example, with reconciliation and these tribunals and others, they are trying to have acknowledgement so that there could be the healing to follow. And of course, that healing is not also something we should let the Armenians do alone. The Turks also have to be involved in that healing process together with the Armenians. That is the difference as well.
We have a question from
yes.
Ksenia.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your work. I think it's equally fascinating and important. And the first part of the question is, to what extent we can use the framework you have developed here to study other persecutions of minorities in Turkey?
Yes.
Like
yes.
People are talking about the Greek genocide. So to what extent is that applicable?
Yeah.
And to what extent, if, like, forgive me, I'm generalizing, can we say that, like, that sort of violence would be the base of the contemporary Turkish state and
yeah.
contemporary
yeah.
Turkish identity?
Well, that's why I said it's a foundational violence, and that is why it's so difficult. The Greek room also faced it. Assyrians are another important group. Greek room from the Trabzon area are also important. The Kurds are basically the Kurds, half of whom participated as perpetrators, half of whom protected the Armenians, also now say that, you know, at the time the Armenians said to them, we were breakfast, you're going to be lunch and dinner. And in a way, that massacre has continued, one can argue, to this day. So after working on the Armenians, I'm going to work on the Kurds next to see what the pattern of violence is in that case. And I'm going to give a talk at the Assyrian genocide. They're having a conference as well. And whenever I usually talk about these things, there are Greeks and, you know, others, and they say, what about ours? And I say, take a ticket and get in line, because in general, I mean, it is a vast project. I mean, this is a denial that has continued throughout the Turkish Republic. So it's going to be very hard. And the more you put it off, the harder it is going to be for us to come to terms. Another reason why these things were not discussed in Turkey is that there literally wasn't any time to discuss it from 1911, to literally 1990. So we're talking, you know, 70 years. Why? Because first there was the war in in what is today Libya against the Italians. Then there were the Balkan Wars, 12 to 13. After that was the First World War, 14 to 18. Then there was the Independence War, 18 to 22. So we had people literally fighting from 1912 to 22 for 10 years straight. The population of the country, of course, especially the males, almost were decimated. And then after that, the Republic is founded, but suddenly there's the unrest that leads to Second World War, 38 to 45. After the Second World War, there is the Cold War that goes from 45 to 89. It's only after the fall of the Berlin Wall that in the last, then, let's say 20 years, that this is a topic that is being talked about in Turkey. And that is why, with time, I think, Turkish society is going to come to terms and acknowledge gradually. I know that I'm not the only one working on this. There is a lot of other people, and the younger generations especially are very interested in these topics. As a consequence, it's a matter of time. That acknowledgement would come.
Sorry, but
Lori,
sorry. Excuse
me.
Second World War.
I'll get you. There's two people ahead of you.
Say Turkey was involved in the Second World War. Well, let me bring what I want, because I'm the one who's giving the talk. You're not. Thank you.
Lori.
Yes.
Thank you for a very interesting talk.
Thank you.
I'm curious to hear what you think, or what you would like to see, either the government of the Republic of Armenia, or Armenian scholars in Armenia or here, or Armenian society in Armenia or here,
yeah.
do to
in
make reconciliation more possible on their side. How do you think the discourse needs to change among any of those?
Yeah, well, thank you. That is a very important question. With reconciliation, I think it is important. There is a lot of disagreement within Armenian communities as to what needs to be done. Then there is a lot of issues about who is going to be the people with whom the Turkish state is going to deal. I do not go into that. I'm not a diplomat. From my point of view, what's important is that I have the Turkish civil society that I hope through getting the new knowledge that is now produced will be able to reach out to the Armenian civil society, you know, either the diaspora or the ones in Armenia. I have been to Armenia, however, once, and there the thinking is very different from the thinking in the diaspora. I mean, they seem to be way back in another time because of the Soviet influence. They never were able to come to terms. But the diaspora doesn't have the state structure through which to engage in these. So that is the major problem. But if you put this civil society organizations together, I'm a part of Project 2015, and we're taking a large group of diasporas, Armenians, to Turkey. I think the important thing is to be able to slowly then get people talking to each other, because I think the change will not come at the level of the state. State always, they think with their brains, they don't have hearts. And they think about their own interests. It's humans, I think, that will pressure eventually people, you know, to think. And now we do have a very significant group of people, both among the Turks and Armenian, diaspora Armenians, that are working together. And once, for example, at Michigan, I work with the Armenian Studies Program. All the Turks learn Armenian and all the Armenians learn Turkish, and they write and work together. And they, of course, are way ahead of us in terms of what is possible. It is when you have such joint ventures that things are going to change. So that's the only thing I can do as a scholar. The rest, I don't know about. I'm not a lawyer or a diplomat, thankfully. They should figure those out themselves. Yes, please go ahead.
Yes.
First, thank you for coming to Cornell to talk about this.
My pleasure.
Second, it looks from your comments that one day the Turkish government may acknowledge this.
Yes, yes. But they think that the later they do it, the less costly it will be for them. That is the whole idea, basically. And for them, it's a matter of cost. It's not a matter of moral conscience.
When did they come?
I would say, given the level of scholarship that's emerging, probably a decade or two at most. I was hoping it would be by 2015, but obviously I was wrong. I mean, the pace is much more glacial than I would like it to be, but my specialty is social change, so I know how these things work, and they work very slowly.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Yes, please go ahead.
Is there somebody else?
No.
I'm just curious, you mentioned the dialogue that's beginning to take place
yes.
in Turkey.
Yeah.
I'm curious about how that works with the legal system in place and that it's
yes,
illegal.
Yes, yes. Well, this is very important because, for example, I formally and informally talk to officials, consul generals and things like that, because they for a while tried to attend our conferences and workshops, and we wouldn't let them, of course. But because of that, you know, they usually tell me, you're okay as long as you stay in the academic environment. If you do not go out, you know, to the newspapers and, you know, in Turkey and try to, you know, tell people what to think, which I don't anyhow. How should I? I mean, you know, I only give talks in university settings, and that's what I limit my thing to. And some of them, for example, now when I give talks, they send messages to me saying, you know, the consul generals, well, we're not coming to your talk because if we come, we have to make a certain statement, and we don't want to make that statement, therefore we're not coming. So in a way, they are censoring themselves in order not to appear there. And for the first time, when I gave a talk at MIT, the Turkish and Armenian student organizations co-sponsored the talk. So that is the kind of, you know, positive development that would happen. And I think eventually it's events like those and others, both in Turkey and here, that are going to change the way things are going to be. Yeah, yeah, from academia. Because academia is a controlled space. So there you can't come. And you can't say, as often happens, I only read one article and I know what you're saying is wrong. And you say, look, I've read, you know, hundreds and thousands of books and articles. You can't just come and say that. That's a political stand. It's not an academic stand. That is why I only stay in academia, because otherwise it will get out of hand. Yes?
Can I ask you a question?
Sure, sure.
Periodization.
Yes.
We talked about this before. I'm still really not feeling good with it.
Okay.
So you start your book all the way back in 1789,
yes,
because you say that it's really, it's kind of like the beginning of an effective effort by the state to modernize.
Yes.
But then you put on the chart of when the violence takes place, and it's more than 100 years later.
Yes. Yeah. Also,
how do you connect the two? How do you connect 1894, 95 with 1789?
The fact that it is so much later is because of the reform efforts in 1839, 56, and 76. Those reform efforts, initially, the minorities in general, Armenians in particular, who also in 1863 drew the first constitution of the Ottoman Empire, actually, are hopeful, and they are thinking it's going to work, it's going to work. I mean, you know, and then one, they realize the 1839 one is not going to work, then they say 1856 may work. And then that also doesn't work, they say 1876 will. So in a way, it's during that time, not only, you know, is there a lot of hope that things will eventually work out, but Western style education starts. There's a lot of minority education, as well as, you know, education of the young Turks and sort of in the schools. A whole generation comes, and that's why it takes a very long time initially, and then it starts, you know, moving very fast.
So it wasn't really a build-up for violence. It was just like it's by nature modernity, we think, might have led to.
Yes, by nature it does. Yes, go ahead.
Before Xenia, there's
yes,
knowing that you could face imprisonment by the officials, what prompted you, drove you to this issue and bring it up?
Well, you see, I used to have a much softer approach. I, for example, initially did not even call what happened genocide, because I said it wasn't fair to all the Turks who had no idea what had happened in their past to suddenly, because of the educational system, to suddenly say to them, you're all, you know, your parents were all, you know, perpetrators and you're all, you know, genocidal. But I said, let them first learn what happened. Let us write books and teach them, and then they can decide and will come with us and say that what happened was a genocide. What was very important for me was the assassination of Hrant Dink. He was a personal friend. I knew him for many long times. He, actually, the Turkish state didn't give him a passport. The first time he got a passport was to attend a workshop we held at University of Michigan Ann Arbor in the year 2002. And then afterwards, when he became assassinated, I lost my faith in both Turkish state and society. And I said, I think that was also a defining moment for a lot of moment for a lot of us Turkish intellectuals. And then after, I said, this is it. And interestingly enough, he was assassinated because he was Armenian, of course, but he was also assassinated as a way to stop all of us from talking. Because I get a lot of death threats also from Turks, you know. But the interesting thing is, after that assassination, I said, it's rather than preventing me, it even made me more committed. Because as a scholar, this is the only thing we do. Our only luxury is to ask the questions we want to ask and work on it until we get an answer. If not, I could go into business and some other area and, you know, have a good time. This is the only thing that keeps me in academia, and that's why I became even more committed to this than I would have otherwise. Yes. Yes.
Okay, sort of two-part question.
Sure, go ahead.
Maybe two questions. Can you give us an idea of the numbers of casualties that happened with the Greeks and the other minority groups? Because, I mean, I know very well as an Armenian this 1.5 million number, but I have no idea about the impact of the Ottoman government on these other...
Well, the others are less. I mean, they're usually into 50 to 100,000 range. So that's why there is a difference. Of course, if you're a much smaller community, as the case of the Assyrians, that would mean a much larger percentage of it. But in terms of the total loss, Armenians definitely suffered much more than the others did. And with the Greeks, it starts in 1912 and 13 on the Aegean coast. There is Celal Bayar is effective there. They engage in a lot of violence to scare them off, and about 100 to 300,000 Greeks leave for Greece. So that is the, usually they say the preamble for the Armenian genocide, because a lot of people who are involved in that then become involved not only in the Armenian massacres, but also later on the Kurdish ones too. And in the meanwhile, because of what happens in 1917, there are about 60 to 80,000 Turks who are murdered and massacred by Armenians as well, with Antranik and others in the east. Once the Russian Revolution occurs, the Russians withdraw, and then the Armenians there are there, and in order to sustain their rule there, that is when they engage. So if you go, for example, to Eastern Anatolia, most of the Turks there remember that massacre too, which is interesting, and you know, but of course the ones on the west do not. It's a partial thing, yes.
It got me thinking when you said, oh, they might acknowledge in the next, you know, decade or two. What's going to happen? What's going to happen? Like,
well, you
are
see,
they going to be giving reparations?
Yes.
What are the parameters?
You see, from my point of view, what I know as a social scientist, and the question you asked too about, you know, how is the healing process going to happen? To me, the acknowledgement is important because of the ability of the people to heal. Because whenever I talk to diaspora Armenians, they especially say, we do not want our children to grow up with this hatred. I mean, you know, because hatred is a negative force. And also it destroys your trust in humanity. And, you know, and unlike the grandparents, you know, who actually experienced the whole thing, they only have to live with this hatred. I mean, you know, and that's very hard to negotiate. For that reason, I think, for me, the acknowledgement is the most important part. People say, with respect to reparation, I was just in Canada on this panel with some people, they say that the cost, they made calculations, I don't know how, $50 to $100 billion is what needs to be paid, but to whom, how? I'm just saying what they $1 billion. Yes.
That is nothing. That is like.
Yeah.
All right.
So I don't know. I mean, you know, land. There are these are all places I went for 5 summers in a row, 2001 to 2006, and went through all of the, you know, what was once Western Armenia. All the people who are settled there are mostly Kurds. So I don't know. The Kurds also don't listen to what the Turks say either. So it has to be probably worked out with them there. You know, so I don't know. Those are other things that I cannot. But at least I think just emotionally it would be important, just so that people, because a lot of Armenians also say, look, we don't want anything. We just, you know, want it recognized and then we can move on. I mean, for those, what I do is enough. For others who say no, then it's not enough, of course. And I don't know. Let them negotiate that.
I'm going to ask the last question because we were out of time.
Yes.
Do you think it is useful to study the Armenian genocide in the context of the larger genocides that were taking place at the same time, including Turks and Balkans? Because there's a lot of violence, mass violence taking place against the Muslims as well. Does it make sense to study them together to try and figure out a pattern, or do you think this is unique?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, in it, I do study a lot about the Balkan Wars. I mean, you know, the massacres there. I also study the assassination of all the Turkish diplomats in great detail, both with Malkonian and, you know, who was one of the assassins, as well as from the Turkish consular records. So in a way, I am very careful to bring that in. But the problem is there, And this is why it's so hard for people, because in Turkey these things have been repressed for so long. The moment you talk about suffering, the first thing that it comes to their mind is the suffering they have had themselves in their past. But they have to be able to see that this suffering is very different from the suffering that the rest of the people had. In a way that what is most significant about this one is the denial. I don't think the others are denied the same way. That is probably the most important difference that would make it, so to speak, unique. But the denial itself is not unique to this. If you look at the Japanese and how they deny the Nanking massacre or the comfort women, if you look at other countries, you know, there is a lot of violence that occurs that is denied as well. So it would hopefully be an example to that. I mean, I could do it in such comparative context, but because my focus was on the democratization of Turkey, that is why I focused on this one, because this is most important for me, the most important obstacle in front of the democratization of Turkey, which is of concern to me. We have your hand up, okay? Yes, sure, go ahead. Yes.
Go ahead, Laura.
Okay, sorry, I just tried to ask this during the seminar, but it was a little bit off topic. Seeing as how we've ended up in democratization, and sort of ended up with talk of reparations and how now it's sort of like a Kurdish area. I'm wondering what you think, and seeing as how you're now working on the Kurdish issue, I'm wondering how you feel about the fact that the only political institution, the only political party that has actually acknowledged the Armenian genocide as a genocide is the predominantly Kurdish party that is headed there.
That's very important. Yes, they have. And they have publicly apologized too. I don't know how much of that has come here because, you know, it has been translated into English, but in Turkey they always come out, and one of the reasons they hold now in Diyarbakir especially conferences, annual conferences, where they discuss the Armenian, you know, massacres throughout history in much more detail than elsewhere, and the church there is also open to prayer, unlike other churches, you know, in Ahtamar, which are very restricted in terms of prayers. So that is a major difference as well. I think that basically, given also, you know, how Erdogan's government, Justice and Development Party's government, is not only religious but also very nationalistic, and therefore on their way to denial as well, I hoped that since Islamists had also been persecuted in Turkish history, that they would be more open to discussing you know, what had happened to Armenians. That obviously is not going to happen. The Kurds are the only ones whose acknowledgement would definitely make a difference, especially if in the June 7th elections the Kurds are able to go beyond the 10% threshold and become a viable political force in Turkey. That certainly would accelerate the process as well. Yes. I'm hopeful about that. Thank you for having me. Thank you.